ABC Listen. Podcasts, radio, news, music, and more.
Global roaming. We did try to stay weekly. The news said no. So 5 days a week it is. I'm Hamish McDonald.
I'm Geraldine Doogue, and now joined by esteemed colleagues Latika Burke and Kylie Morris. Search for Global Roaming on the ABC Listen app or wherever you get your podcasts.
Hi, this is David Rutledge on ABC Radio National and ABC Listen. Welcome to the Philosopher's Zone. It's great to have your company. This week, we're exploring the relationship between art and politics. I'm always interested to see how, on the whole, people are quite comfortable with the existence of artists who are explicitly political, artists whose work addresses political themes and issues in an overt way. But then, when artists who aren't explicitly political take a swerve into politics or protest, they're often told to stay out of it. We've seen this most recently with the wave of artists who have cancelled their performances at the newly renamed Trump Kennedy Center in New York in protest at the excesses and abuses of the US president and his administration. A lot of the noise on social media in response to these artists has been people yelling at them to stay in their lane, stick to entertainment and stop being agitators. It's like there's a line that's been crossed, but exactly what that line is and where it lies, or even whether or not the line between art and politics exists at all, is a question that gets endlessly wrangled over. But like all really interesting philosophical questions, it resists any kind of easy or uncomplicated answer. Well, my guest this week is Chus Martinez, a curator and art historian with a background in philosophy who was born in Spain. These days, she's director of the Institute Art, Gender, Nature at FHNW Academy of Arts and Design in Basel, Switzerland. But right now, Chus Martinez is in Melbourne, where she's curated an exhibition that will soon be opening at the University of Melbourne's Potter Museum of Art. The title of the exhibition is A Velvet Ant, A Flower and a Bird. We have so many problems today with our civic discourse. It's so fragmented and so hostile. The spaces in which we conduct civic discourse are increasingly polluted. And a very important question for you at the moment, I know, is the question of how art can function as a civic medium. Tell me more about that. What does it mean for art to function in this way?
It's a very complex question, but I am an art enthusiast, and I do think that the fact that art suspends the opinions and the ideologies, that helps a lot to find a common ground. And probably this common ground needs to start very low by conversations and encounters where we all accept that we may be in disagreement or in deep disagreement, but still we agree to meet. I'm very kind of inspired by the fact that Spain, as you know, entered democracy in 78, more or less. Not really. In 78 was the death of Franco. And then a few years later, like I think 81, was the first democratic election. From that point on, many things have been activated under the point of view of the neighborhoods. Like Barcelona, where I grew up, was announcing itself as a city capable of creating spaces where the citizens could meet and producing the city from its neighbors, from its citizens. So even if for many years I did not thought much about it, I kind of see myself thinking about it a lot these days.
As part of that function, art as a civic medium, is that function, among other things, a moral function?
I'm really not good at talking about morals, but definitely is, how can I say it? It's a function that starts with the senses and with perception. And perception plays a major role in thinking. So in that sense, at least perceiving together and kind of adjusting our perceptions of the real before language comes in, it's really an important thing. One that is difficult to describe, but is really fundamental, I think. So I don't know if we can start by morals, but I think at least we should start by the senses, by adjusting how we feel together in the public space, and then depart from that.
Yeah, I guess what I'm getting at with that question is that, I mean, I can see the potential for art in providing a shared space where we can discover more about each other, come to understand each other better. But is it too much to ask of art that it should have this moral dimension. Like it's one thing to say that art shows us how we live, shows us to each other how we live. It's a very different thing to say that art shows us how we should live. I think a lot of artists would push back against that idea. What's your opinion?
Totally. I think I'm not also saying that. I think nothing is a prescription. Art is definitely not normative. But we need the spaces in between. I don't know about Australia, but in Europe, everything has been strictly reordered. Like when you work in a company or you work in a public entity, as I do, the word that you hear the most during the week is controlling. So everything has a bureaucracy attached to it and processes. You work all the time with working processes, workflow. So everything kind of indicates that every step you take needs to be controlled by us or by an entity that's above us. So to just take life outside that controlling system is per se important. I'm not saying that's morally important. I'm saying that's important as an Erlebnis, as Brecht would say, as an experience that is experienced by somebody. So in that sense, I'm not saying that art is telling us how we should live. We should define that ourselves, and probably very differently so, because even disagreement is an incredible, interesting part of life. I don't need to agree, but I need to coexist. So this is a must, at least in my opinion.
Yeah, I see what you're saying there. It's interesting that point about stepping outside of spaces that are controlled, stepping outside of those sort of bureaucratized spaces. In doing that, I mean, is that always inevitably a political move? I can see how that move away from those spaces can be sort of mobilized to political ends. Do you think it's intrinsically political?
Is there something not political? Meaning we need a common agreement to live together. We need at least to accept, tolerate, understand, encompass, produce horizons where we have different orientations. We need to accept, as Gadamer would say, our own prejudices. We need to see that the conditions in which we think and feel and act are part of our decision-making processes. So in that sense, breathing is political as belonging to a world. And if you feel that you are belonging to this world, then you are political. Ideologically, it's a different political question, but at least in a broad sense, it is political.
Tell me more about that difference between the political and the ideological. I think a lot of people sort of conflate those things together.
I'm not a person that used these terms a lot because I'm also conflicted with them. But I do think that right now I want to claim the political dimension of a life that takes into account its responsibility and its duties towards living together with others. So it's super important to acknowledge differences and to learn how to modify your views according to this otherness and these differences, but also towards that common ideal of that life together is possible, that you don't need to fight others or to be antagonic all the time towards others. So in that sense, learning how to coexist is a political task.
I'd like to talk about art and contemporary art. I think I'm really sort of interested in here. And one thing I think about is that, rightly or wrongly, contemporary art often operates at a certain distance from the lives of everyday people, particularly the kind of art that's typically exhibited within mainstream art institutions. And I don't know that there's anything intrinsically wrong with that, but it does seem to complicate this idea that art can bring us all together. And I wonder if you think that there's a sense in which the art that does bring us all together, the art that transcends class and socioeconomic status, really has to be produced and experienced outside the world of galleries and museums and professionally curated spaces. What are your thoughts on that?
I think that we have done something very wrong when people, and especially the media, always portrays contemporary art as distant and not being involved or engage in the life of people and being a question of class exclusivity and intellectual knowledge. We have done something absolutely wrong. I think I come from a rural area of Spain, absolutely defined by poverty. I'm the only person in my village that could study. And I really deeply like contemporary art, but not only like it, I think for me it's one of the most important elements of culture. And I do think and believe that culture in all its forms, literature, art, theater, spoken word, singing, music, constitutes a space that is really amazing and much beyond the constrictions of the working corporative spaces, of the corporative language that defines like a space for everything. So if the museum at certain moment in history has been turning corporative, then we need to correct that. But this is definitely not a problem with the art. It's a problem with the Gefäße, as the Germans would say. It's a problem with the container. So the container, the institutional definition that is not allowing or is not actually putting the resources that we need to maintain the connections in between the people and the works, that's a big problem. But imagine that I would have all the resources to make and maintain these conversations alive daily, that I would go out of the museum and be at schools, as in the 50s in Mexico, where you would have artist studios in public schools, that you would have studios in elderly homes, that you would have artists spread all around the city. Think, why is that less contemporary art than the art that you see in the museums? But yeah, it's the framing of it that so many times produces this idea that is leisure after work. But this is a very Anglo-American perception of the thingy. I think it's not what it should be.
Is that perception deeply rooted, do you think, in a country like Australia? When you come to somewhere like Melbourne, I mean, I'm assuming a certain familiarity with Melbourne there, which maybe you don't have, but if you go to other cities in the West, do you find contemporary art just sort of out and about in various ways? Or is it still something that you really need to go to a museum, to an art gallery, to experience?
I think this is a city also defined by the presence of very powerful universities with an immense amount of expertise and scholars that are not only friendly but very open, and really with a willingness to open up that knowledge to many other people. And sometimes it's some sort of institutional shyness and also the constraints imposed by certain ways of understanding yourself and your function in the social that perhaps is too neat or is just too shy to cross certain borders that makes it that you really think that you need to go to certain places to be exposed to certain types of art or discourses. But little by little, these things would open up, I think. There's an enormous potential in this city to actually hybridize university and museums, and the street, and the studios. And there is an enormous artistic community, which is also incredibly interesting. So yeah, I think we have a task ahead, not only in Melbourne, but in many other cities, to open up the compartments and make them meet and produce a much more active, osmotic relationship in between the containers that contain and make them contain less and open more.
Well, tell me about the upcoming exhibition, A Velvet Ant, A Flower and a Bird. This is opening in a couple of weeks' time at the University of Melbourne's Potter Museum of Art. This is an exhibition that is animated by philosophy, by ideas and concepts, as much as it is by aesthetic concerns. What's the thinking? What's the exhibition about, if I can put it that way?
The mission was to work with the collections that are very diverse and very interesting in the University of Melbourne. And it all started by having conversations with the custodians of those collections and learning about them through them. And it's a very difficult task. How can you exhibit things that are so different, not only in nature, but also in their historical context and so on? And on the other hand, I have my own questions that I brought here. Like, for example, I've been asked many times, but when did art started to be interested in nature? What's the importance of art interacting with science and with life science in particular? Can actually art and life science together change anything of what's going on that we perceive as being wrong, like extractivism and so on and so forth? So I kind of thought about it a lot. And then I came to a moment in the Middle Ages, pre-modern times, that they were really important in Spain. And I actually never had an opportunity to think much about it, which is in the 13th century, Ramon Llull, that was a scholar in the island of Mallorca, he wrote a book called The Book of Animals that was around the 1288 or something like that, 13th century. And 2 centuries later, in the same island, another scholar, Anselm Turmeda, wrote another beautiful book where a donkey is actually questioning all the humans and actually kind of fighting the idea that the human species has any supremacy in relationship with the other species. So I thought it would be really interesting to depart from the bestiaries for that particular genre of the Middle Age and then put 3 entities at the center and the axis of the exhibition. So the first floor is dedicated to flowers, the second floor is dedicated to ants, and the third floor is dedicated to birds. So they are actual flowers, actual ants, and actual birds. But on the other hand, they are also symbolic figures or characters that they help us to understand how we think. I'm very inspired by Mark Turner, which is a linguistic scholar from the States, that in 1996, he wrote a fantastic book that is called The Literary Mind. And he proposes that our brain can only think through parables or through small stories. And then through that inspiration, I've been constructing a very heterogeneous exhibition that has these entities at the center and where you will encounter like ancient Roman coins and contemporary video productions, for example.
It seems like a central idea here is this idea of how knowledge is produced and what we can learn from the natural world about knowledge, about intelligence, this kind of thing. Is that sort of very dominant there?
Yeah, I think cognitive science fascinates me. Also because we are very kind of, we are very keen on adopting supremacist discourses. On the one hand, we dispute them. On the other hand, we love them. Supremacism is kind of in our language, in our everyday life. So everything has this kind of pyramidal form where best practices, for example, no? When you talk about things that are the best in relationship to what. So also with knowledge, now artificial intelligence, because you present it as something that, per definition, it should be better than natural intelligence. But we have a hard time of thinking about how things need to be presented and be perceived as together. So we don't need to, it does not need to be one or the other. So the non-binarism should be active in every time that we just reflect in something. And then I really want people to be able to have time to produce interpretative narratives and interpretative arguments so that they can interpret the world by themselves. We are mediated by everything. We are mediated in our everyday life by our conditions, working conditions, media conditions, relationships through media with others, relationships through problems with others, and relationships problematic with our own selves. So it is kind of important to be in that a space where everything seems so different, and then you have the freedom to connect the things as you wish, in a way, and then start making sense, or the sense you think that needs to be made for you out of them. So I wanted to conceive an exhibition under these premises.
Yeah, and that sense we make of the world, I mean, it seems as though you're talking about it in terms of collective sense-making, collective knowledge building. And I find that interesting because, you know, we're all very used to this idea of art as individual expression. But you're talking about art as something sort of embedded in ecological and social relations here. How does this challenge these traditional ideas of artistic autonomy and authorship?
Totally. I think in 2021, it was this Nobel Prize given to physicists, praising them for defining for the first time complex systems. So the example per excellence of a complex system is a bird flock. So they just said that in a bird flock, how they move and how they act is, and what they can do together is radically different than what they can do as individual birds. So there is something to be understood, and it's a very complex thing. We cannot really just describe it and think that we understood it. But it would be good to reflect on the fact, well, we can do as a society what we cannot do as individuals, and seeing our limits in a joyful way, not only as a supremacist limit, you know, like, oh my God, I cannot do that and I am less because I cannot do it. But I am who I am, but when I am with others, I am gaining some possibilities that are emanating from this being together. And I'm still thinking about it, but I do think that it's really important, this togetherness right now, because otherwise the other groups that are really together and they are against all the values that we have been constructing, I think, of course, I'm talking now from the side of equality, rights and democracy. I do believe in it deeply. Of course, I'm a child of the first democratic Spain, but yeah, there is so many people right now, I think, in my own country, the congresses of the far right have been proliferating in the last three years. They meet all the time and they define their common goals all the time. But I think, and I really want to invite us to do the same, because my goal is to keep my rights.
On ABC Radio National and ABC Listen, this is The Philosopher's Zone with me, David Rutledge. And this week, I'm talking with the internationally renowned curator and art historian, Chus Martinez. Chus has curated a wonderful exhibition that's going to be opening shortly in Melbourne, A Velvet Ant, A Flower and A Bird. More details at the end of the show. This reminds me of some comments that you made in an interview last year that I thought were really interesting. I mean, you mentioned that you came from this small village in Spain where you estimated that 90% of the people in that village vote conservative or right wing. And this would seem to put 90% of the people in your village on the far side of a deep political divide, like the other side from where you sit politically. And yet you said that these conservative or right wing voters and you all want the same thing, that these people are not the enemy, they're not the problem. You said that the people are never the problem because they are us.
No.
Can you explain more about that?
It's really interesting. I've been all this Christmas, I spent it in my village. We are, in the census last year, we were 796 people, divided almost equally women and men. So it's a super small village. We know, everyone knows each other. And so we kind of grow up together and it's different generations and everyone is kind of linked to everyone else. And definitely I am from a small niche. As I said, very few people went to school, primary school, but almost very few made it into secondary school. And to go to university, you would need to drive for 1 hour and 20 minutes. And then you would need to have a room in the city. The average salary is really, really low. So to have a child studying, it means that you would need to support it. And it's very difficult to find a part-time job. So it makes it so difficult that people give up. I think you cannot have it. And we are talking here about technical studies, mostly to become some sort of a professional, not scholarly studies to become a professor at the university. That's not the goal of the majority of them. But yeah, I think they want the same. They want better opportunities and they want a better life. And they thought that this would be coming their way and it didn't. So now, coming from the worst conditions ever, some of them are developing this kind of delusional fantasies that we can come to the past. So this Christmas, I was just on the top of a table in the restaurant bar in my village, like on the table of the bar, screaming at all of them, elderly and people my age, and telling them what is the past that we are talking about. I think it was the past where my mother, that's rich, like she married at 23 years of age. At 24, she moved to Barcelona and then attended night school. At night school, she learned how to read and write. Imagine Europe. I think this was like, what, compared with France or Germany, that's kind of, you know, dark age. Then what is the, I think she couldn't really access certain types of food like that they were enough not to become chronic rheumatic. Her sister, the same. And the half of the village, the same. So, but now are they claiming that the past was better? Which past? Not true. So, you know, by talking and addressing this kind of fantasies, this kind of delusions together, we were like able to talk. I think they were screaming back at me and, you know, calling me, I don't know, feminazi, that's the word that they use.
Yeah.
Like, I am a feminazi, you know, a feminist, radicalized, leftist, and so on. So we spent a couple of hours screaming at each other. But next morning, went to the baker, and then they all said, like, fuck, was good yesterday night. We have such a good encounter. Imagine I could repeat it. I love that.
Mm.
We don't agree, but we don't need to agree because it's a process. It's a process that it would take time because we used to agree at a certain point. I think I'm saying that the village is quite radicalized now, but of course, 15, 20 years ago, it was the same people voting in the Socialist Party.
Mm.
So they vote according to their life horizon, which is something that we need to acknowledge. We need to have some respect for those that go that way, even if definitely it's not my way.
Yeah, I like this idea of therapeutic screaming. I mean, it does seem, though, I mean, there's so much non-therapeutic screaming going on. You know, the political left and the political right have never seemed more mutually hostile than they are now.
I know.
So if the right is not the enemy of the left then, and the left is not the enemy of the right, we all want the same things, then who is the enemy?
No. The right does not want the same things. I think I've said
the
people.
The right doesn't want the same things, okay.
No. The people in my village, they want the same thing as me because I know them and I know what they want. And what they want is different from what the far right is wanting. The leaders of the far right, at least in Spain, are despicable people. So they are dishonest. But I would like to talk about the dishonesty of those initiating that polemic, that they want to poison the people of villages like mine. And that was our conversation. I was saying to them, they are not defending your interest. They are lying to you. So it's important to go through this together and then try to figure out. I also don't want to convince them to vote the same as I do. This is democracy. People can vote what they think. But it's good to openly talk about that.
I have a couple of questions about cultural production. You know, it interests me that cultural content today is more available to more of us than ever before. When you think about music, you know, and not just the fact that any piece of recorded music from any point in the history of recorded music can now be just easily found and enjoyed online, but also the fact that music production technology is at the point where anyone with a bit of cash can make music that used to cost hundreds of thousands of dollars to make. It's quite incredible. And I guess there's a similar story to be told about the visual arts. And yet, in the midst of all this opportunity, all this plenitude, I feel like there's something fundamental about culture today that is sick or dying, or, you know, or something about our regard for culture, our love for culture that's dying. And I wonder if you see it that way and what you think might be causing it.
Tiredness, the fact that we are perceived as not giving what we were supposed to give, and that the promise lies somewhere else. Kind of in the 2000s on, it was this promise of producing a creative class and everyone being able to express themselves and develop and fulfill their dreams through culture. Museums were created nonstop in many places, in many cities, in many contexts. And then this kind of openness, little by little, has been collapsing by the emergence of a radical technological, different, more immediate, more able to reach you technology, the pandemic, the fact that you were home, trapped, and they could reach you, they catch you. So Netflix catch you, Instagram catch you, TikTok catch you. You were there alone at home. So they came and they got you. And then after the pandemic, you are already there. And then you see through the lens of that day where you were, and then you look at the culture and you see that it's not that dynamic. It doesn't look like the TikTok video, the memes that are proliferating, all this humor, all this kind of social commentary, the aggressiveness that is growing in the political, everything seems even more dynamic than culture. And yet I do believe that culture is it. And then the sadness of seeing that You look at the Emirates. For example, I was in a conversation a week ago, and they were telling me that they are educating around 17,000 music teachers to incorporate in their school systems from kindergarten to university. And they already, they managed to educate 9,000 of them. Until 2030, they are going to manage to have 17,000. And then you look at the BBC radio in the 70s when they were interviewing David Munro, and everyone was talking about elderly medieval music, and everyone was enthusiastic about listening to a sound that was not real. So yes, I do believe that we can really reinvigorate that enthusiasm and motivation, but it needs a social contract to do that. If every politician and every media is skeptical about culture and not as skeptical about Netflix, then we have a problem. So why is this skepticism going always our way? We also need to ask ourselves, are we equally skeptical about other forms of, holding the motivation of people?
Yeah, that's interesting. I mean, I think there's also a really interesting tension where, you know, on one hand, it's wonderful that anyone can produce art now. Like there's a lot less institutional gatekeeping. The technology for digital art production has become relatively cheap. The whole question of who gets to be an artist has been thrown wide open, which is great. But one result of this great democratization of artistic practice is suddenly that there is just so much art out there, which is fine in theory, but if you're a professional artist operating in the art market, then you have a problem because you're dealing in a currency that's becoming more and more devalued through excess supply. I'm sort of using these mercantile metaphors very deliberately. What are your thoughts on that?
I think the idea that you need a mediator to become an expert is not there anymore. So everyone, as you are saying, can do it. Everyone is doing it. Everyone is kind of self-proclaiming something, a hack, no? If you go on the internet, everyone is a hacker. They hack everything from cleaning for cooking, putting order into your wardrobe, everything. You can hack it. Art can be hacked. University, hack it. But the thing is that there is not enough viewers, there is not enough listeners, and there is not enough readers. No one is actually watching, reading, doing actively perception and reception of it. Gadamer, much later, the idea of producing interpretation and how interpretation is super important. So I would think that right now what we need is to learn how to interpret that mass that we have in front of us and have moments for reflecting and stop making. I think that that's enough.
Well, I'd like to finish with philosophy and the current institutional problems that philosophy is facing, particularly within academia. I read another recent interview of yours where you described the closure of philosophy departments and classical studies departments as a kind of slow autoimmune disease that's affecting democracy. Tell me about that disease and about the capacities that we're losing as these changes take place in our universities.
Yeah, imagine that you just identify a protein in the body that it seems to do nothing. And then you just eliminate it in everybody to discover 20 years later that actually it was key to metabolize the sunlight and make you, make you not to relapse into a brutal depression or something like that, to say something. So, of course, from the outside, a philosophy and classic departments, they kind of look like good for nothing. But if you read what happened in relationship to Brexit, it's actually interesting, this cause and effect, that the small bubbles that they were producing, the air that these small forests were producing inside the social, was a really beautiful breathe air. And then if you collapse that air, then something really fundamentally wrong goes on. So they did not cost a lot if you put it in relationship with what it would cost to follow the demands of the far right. But I really think that there is something to think about, that they were really, sponging that density of the corporative tech world. It would be fantastic to have them back. I do think that we really need philosophers and ancient scholars to just modulate and produce that air we need to cope with what's coming. And I cannot really articulate it smart enough so that you would believe yourself what I'm saying, but there is something there that I know it has an impact. And it's not by chance that it happened in England first, and then they had Brexit a few years later.
Chus Martinez, director of the Institute Art Gender Nature at FHNW Academy of Arts and Design in Basel, Switzerland, and curator of a new exhibition about to open at the University of Melbourne's Potter Museum of Art, A Velvet Ant, A Flower and a Bird. You can find details on the Philosopher's Zone website, and as always, you can listen to this episode and many, many years' worth of past episodes at ABC Listen. The Philosopher's Zone is produced on Bundjalung land by me, David Rutledge. Thanks so much for your company this week, and I hope you'll join me next time. Bye for now.